DCT Audio. The art of good listening.
You're listening to a podcast on the Audio Boom Network. This is A Mindful Life with me, Dave Thomas. Thank you for downloading this edition of the program. I do hope you enjoy it.
Matt Johnson, a very warm welcome to A Mindful Life. Now, Matt, I know you're a former soldier, a former police officer in the Metropolitan Police, and then you took to writing books on retirement, but I believe that was part of a therapy process for the PTSD that you'd suffered at the time. Could you be able to just explain that journey a little?
Yeah, that's going back to 1999. I'd suffered some strange sort of symptoms at work, which had resulted in me being place sick. Doctor decided that it would be a good idea for me to see a counsellor. Eventually ended up seeing a psychologist and got diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, this was a time when I'd never heard of PTSD.
No, I don't think most people had they?
No, it was, we'd heard of things like combat stress because that was a familiar condition, but PTSD, that was a fairly new concept. And I was very lucky that I was actually under the care of a pretty enlightened counsellor. Because what we found was, while I was doing sessions with her, I would become overwhelmed by emotion when she asked me to talk about my symptoms, about my experiences, about how it affected my home life, that kind of thing. And so she said to me one day, because I was getting so overwhelmed by the emotions during these discussions, that it might be a good idea if I tried writing about my experiences and things. So what we agreed was that each week she would set me some homework and I would go home and I would sit at a computer and just write a Word document answering her questions at a time where I felt up to it. So I wasn't under pressure. And if things started to get a bit too much for me, I could stop and then I'd come back to it another time. And then by the end of the week, I would have something ready to take back to her. Now, when we first started it, I wasn't very good at it at all. I couldn't write very much. I used to find it a bit overwhelming. But in the end, I started to find it quite cathartic and I was able to write more and more. And one day she said to me, have I ever considered writing a book? What she had in mind was to write an autobiographical account type of detailing my personal experiences. And I thought that's not going to work because I was an inspector working at a place called Stoke Newington in North London, a place that many people had never heard of. Nobody had ever heard of me. And I said to her, look, the best I could hope for, even if I was fortunate enough to get this book published that you're suggesting I should write, would be that it would be sat on the shelf of some university archive somewhere, gathering dust to be picked up by the odd student who happened to be researching the subject and would pick up to learn a bit about my particular experiences of PTSD. I said, I don't think I want to do that. So, no, I forgot about the idea. And then a few years later, 2012 it was, in fact, I read in the news, I'd retired by then, and I was living in South Wales, and I was getting my ill-health pension, and things were okay. And a chap called Michael Pemberton committed suicide in 2012. Michael was the lead horseman at the Hyde Park bombing and had been riding Sefton. And I had been on duty on the day of the Hyde Park bombing. I'd not actually been to Hyde Park, but I'd been to the Regent's Park bombing that happened later that same day. And I thought to myself, do you know, there really is, because Michael killed himself because of PTSD. He'd been discharged from the army. He never fully recovered. And so 30 years effectively after the Hyde Park bombing, and it claimed another victim. And I thought, you know, maybe that counsellor did have a point. Maybe it would be worth making the effort to sort of try and sort of explain to people, get across a message about PTSD. But I thought, again, that same problem about a book is not going to get read by people. And then my brother said, well, why don't you set the story to fiction? He said, weave your story, your experiences, into a novel. Novels are read by far more people. She said, it's not going to be a dry, uninteresting story about an inspector for Snoke Newton. You said you can make it a fast crime thriller and inject your own personal experiences into it. So I thought, well, okay, I'll give it a go. I got very lucky. I wrote the book. Initially, I didn't get it published, but then I'd managed to get an agent, got it published, and the book did very well. The book was called Wicked Game. I think it came out in 2016. In its first year, it was nominated for a Crime Writers Association Dagger Award, and it became the highest rated debut novel on Amazon that year, Amazon UK.
Was it a hard book to write for you?
It was at times. Yeah. I would find, again, I would be writing stuff and it would be bringing stuff to the surface. And there are times when I would have to stop, walk away from the computer because things were getting a bit uncomfortable. But, David, the more I did it, the easier it became.
Good.
And I stuck at it. And that persistency paid dividends because it ended up being a very healing, cathartic experience for me. Mm. And when it got published, I would then find that I would get invitations to appear at things like literary festivals and do interviews. And people would want to talk about that process as we're talking now.
Yeah, they say the trauma's always there, don't they? But it's you've obviously learnt, and it's an easy thing to say, so hard to do, is that you've, I suppose, detached yourself from that trauma. You're not involved with it anymore.
No. It's almost as if you've transferred it to the written word.
So how many books have you written now?
I've written five now.
Including the book we're about to talk about.
I've written four novels.
Uh-huh.
This book, No Ordinary Day, the story of the Yvonne Fletcher shooting and the aftermath, is my first, I call it my first attempt at writing nonfiction. And my literary agent, Brew, tells me off when she says, it's hardly an attempt.
Well,
because it's been very well received, and I've been...
It has been very well received. And we were just talking, weren't we, earlier in the bar, that I'm not a big book reader. I suffer with concentration and patience. And I have to say, it's probably one of the few books that I've actually read page to page. I'm not just saying that because you're sat in front of me. And I didn't put it down. And as other reviewers have said, you have to remind yourself that this isn't a work of fiction.
Mm.
This is, it actually happened. And it's certainly a book that is absolutely dripping in facts. I think one of the best reviews that you had was from the Police Federation magazines, or you effectively your peers, aren't they? And they say that it leaves the reader in no doubt that this is one of the most important books written about policing in the past 40 years, which was a nice review to get that.
It was a surprising one as well. And I didn't think they were going to say something nice about it. I didn't know what they were going to say about it. I knew the book had been sent to the Police Federation. I knew they were looking at it. It was quite a while before it actually came out. And I confessed I feared that it had either disappeared down a dark hole or that they'd read it and thought, no, this is not for us. So when that review came out and they reviewed it in the August issue of the Federation magazine and I read it, I was dumbfounded. Yeah. It was quite surreal that they should be so complimentary about it.
Well, I think you've done a very good job, and I would always say your book goes a little bit further, and it's almost an epitaph to Yvonne, and to John's resilience.
Yes, it is. I mean, and that came about because while I was like starting off working on the story with John knew what had happened, as we all did. We knew where it had happened. We had an idea of who was responsible, but there was always this mystery about why this had happened and why the people involved had been allowed to leave the country without being arrested or prosecuted. That was a mystery. And so that was essentially where John's gave me my head and said, see what you can find. I started by talking to journalists. I spoke to the likes of Kate Adey, who was amazingly helpful. Would you believe I even spoke to John le Carré? Because I knew there was Secret Service involvement. I knew John le Carré had read my novels and was a fan of them. And indeed, I'd even been to John le Carré's place down in Cornwall and had cream tea with him, which was absolutely fantastic. So I had his phone number. Yeah, I had his phone number, and I looked at it on my phone, and I thought, do you know, what have I got to lose? I'm going to ring him up and say, I'm researching this book. What would you do in my position? Where would you look? And he pointed me in the direction of the National Archives, and he suggested there were certain files within the National Archives that I ought to have a look at. And I went down to the National Archives, and I got these files out. And what we learned started to reveal the picture of what had really been happening in 1984. That led to a series of Freedom of Information requests to the Home Office and the Foreign Office, which took absolutely ages, the best part of a year,
wow,
to finally get the information out of them. So it was a slow old process. And eventually I ended up with like a three-dimensional jigsaw of information that somehow I needed to paste together into a narrative which explained the story in a way that made sense. And that was absolutely the hardest part.
And it would be easy, wouldn't it, as investigators, you know, the old saying is, you know, don't take your eye off the squirrel. It'd be so easy to start making some assumptions to make those pieces fit. So you've done very well that you didn't actually do that.
There's, I mean, there's a former detective superintendent for the Met who said to me, when I started writing it, asked me how I was getting on, and I told him the problems I was experiencing. He said, do you feel like you're running a major internet inquiry but doing it entirely on your own? And I said, yes, yeah, that's exactly how I feel. I said, I've got my action book with all my little things that I need to do. And I said, I've got all my list of actions. I said, I haven't got a group of DCs and PCs that I can I've got to do them all myself.
When I was reading the book, it's really strange to say that. I was thinking to myself, does he have a whiteboard on the wall? Has he got a timeline going? Has he got a tree, family tree going? You know, all these things.
Absolutely true. Yes, to all of that. Yeah. Yes, to all of that. It was, I had this, all these post-it notes all over the place with various bits of information. And gradually, the post-it notes would start to come down as each bit started to piece together. And then of course, you read it through the first time and you think, no, this doesn't make sense. So then you've then got to go back and then try and smooth out the erratic stuff that's in the narrative until it makes a smoother story. And then, of course, what happens is you put it in the hands of an editor and they do the same thing for you. And they editors have this incredible skill to sort of take the author's ideas and words and just smooth out the rough edges.
John Murray was alone in the small waiting room for about an hour and a half before the doctor he'd met earlier came back to see him. This time, the doctor had taken his mask and cap off. John could see he was young, around his own age. I'm sorry, he said to John, his voice solemn, his gaze fixed at the floor, before he began to cry. Your friend died on the operating table. There was too much internal damage. Her spleen was in pieces. John stepped forward, held out his arms, and the two men embraced as they cried together.
That paragraph for me was one of the most moving sections of the book. But what do you remember that about that awful day?
I was a PC at the time, 1984. I had 6 years service. I was a class one driver. And at the time I was on traffic. I hadn't been a class one for very long, just a matter of a few months. And I was driving a central London traffic car. Call sign, as I recall, was Oscar Echo 15. And our job on the day was to do with the central London traffic, serious road traffic accidents, and ambulance escorts. And on this particular morning, I was driving, and with my colleague, we were sent to Regent Street to pick up an ambulance to take it to the Westminster Hospital. That's all we knew. It was an ambulance on the hurry-up job. We arrived in Regent Street at the end of Charles II Street, which leads down to St. James's Square. I didn't know there'd been a demonstration going on that morning. I didn't know what had happened. It was simply an ambulance escort for me. I didn't know that in that ambulance was Yvonne Fletcher and John Murray. Pulled out in front of the ambulance, we did the escort, got them to the hospital as quickly as we could. Just before we got to the hospital, the ambulance actually overtook us because we had to stop at some red traffic lights, jump out the police car, wave the traffic to one side so that the ambulance could get through. They overtook us. They went in. By the time we pulled in behind them at the hospital, the back of the ambulance was open. There was nobody there. There was all this debris and blood and bandages and things like that. And everybody had gone in. So at that point, we didn't even know it was a police officer that had been shot. We resumed normal patrol, back out, and then rumours started to come through the police network, as they do, of what had happened. And then of WPC had been shot. And there was some rumours went round that an inspector had been shot as well, which actually proved to be unfounded. And then we heard rumours that she died. Still didn't know who she was. Finished work that afternoon, went home. 6 o'clock news came on, and the picture of Yvonne Fletcher came on the 6 o'clock news. Now, I was sitting in the lounge of a house I'd quite recently bought with my first wife. We were sitting on tea chests because we didn't have any proper furniture. We had our television resting on a tea chest. We had a coffee table made out of tea chests. And Yvonne's picture came on the telly, and it was a shock because Yvonne had been at our housewarming party, and she was a good friend of my first wife, and they'd worked on the Tom Squad, the prostitution squad in West End Central Police Station, and they knew each other really well. I was involved in the siege in as much as I was assigned as a driver to the Special Air Service. And so where they were ensconced at Northolt, RAF Northolt, I was essentially using a police traffic car, was a taxi service to them, driving their research people in and around North London as they researched their entry, as they were planning their entry to the embassy. So I got to know some of their guys quite well. So there was things going on in the background. And then I was involved again later that week because I'd wanted to go to the funeral on the Friday, as I recall. And my superintendent in charge of the traffic unit I was in had denied me permission. From his point of view, it was the right pragmatic decision in a way. It was. Because all the officers from Yvonne's home division were all being given permission to go to the funeral. They were all going, which meant that coverage had to be provided by officers on the adjacent areas, including us, to make up for the fact that they were all going to be at the funeral. My wife went to the funeral. I was told no, I couldn't go, even though she was a friend. And I was very upset about that, livid.
I can imagine.
Even to the point of like, I'm thinking of walking out. And
yeah, I'm going regardless.
Yes, I'm going. No, I'm going. I'm just quitting, leaving. You know, I was so cross about it at the time. And then they asked for volunteers on the night duty before the funeral to go down and jiggle some of the cars that were in the square to move them out of the way to facilitate the extraction of the Libyans on the day that they were leaving. And I volunteered to do that. So I went down there quite late in the evening, and I was standing there just by the armoured Land Rover, just around the corner from the entrance to the embassy. We were just about to be given this bulletproof vest to wear, and I was suddenly aware of like a figure moving past me. Didn't really clock what it was. And then there were shouts, "Get back, get back." And we thought, what the hell's going on? And then all the armed PCs who were with us were looking out into the square in the direction of the embassy. And I can see that they're shouting at somebody or something to get back. Next thing I know, a PC appears carrying Yvonne Fletcher's hat.
Oh, we'll just hold that thought because we're going to talk about that a little bit later.
Despite another disturbed night, in the morning, John decided he would head into work. A decision had been made to post him as station officer, manning the front counter at the police station, in the hope it would be easier for him. A large number of people, many of whom knew Yvonne, began turning up with flowers, cards, and donations for her family. John had to deal with them all. I remember one chap came in, who said he was a wealthy Libyan businessman. He recalls, he handed me £5,000 in cash and said it was on behalf of the Libyan people for what had happened. Soon the police charity box was full and the front counter was chock-a-block with cards and flowers. I knew the bosses meant well, but it was probably the worst place they could have put me.
Clearly Yvonne was well-liked and, dare I say, loved. Are you able to describe Yvonne to us?
Well, yes. I mean, Yvonne John Murray knows Yvonne so much better than I do, and many of the people that work with John and with Yvonne a lot, they know her. I knew Yvonne socially, really, and through stories. She was somebody of an effervescent personality, a sharp wit, a much bigger personality than her small frame. She was the smallest WPC in the whole of the Met. She'd got in because she was such an amazing person. She was very sharp-witted. There are stories in the book of conversations she had with famous actors and people like that. And she would have a laugh and a joke with them. Sharp, witty, made them laugh, put a smile on people's faces. So typical of Yvonne. She was very popular. She was very good at training young officers. She learned the job very quickly. She was very hardworking, a real grafter. Highly respected. She had the nickname Super Fletch because of the nature that she was. You know, she was a super officer and very, very popular.
The frustration of not being able to detain those suspected of the murder was felt by every officer. In every police station, every office, every canteen, a lot of questions were being asked. Why had Yvonne Fletcher been shot? Why had those in government appeared so desperate to have the matter resolved? Why hadn't the officers policing the demonstration been warned of the danger? Why had key suspects wanted for questioning been deported before detectives were allowed to interview them? We knew what had happened and how, said John Murray. What we didn't know was who had done it and why. Pretty soon, we were demanding answers.
Now, the book is clear in its tribute to Yvonne and also to John Murray's 37-year campaign to seek justice for Yvonne, a promise he made to her as she lay dying on the pavement. But very early on, it became clear that the police investigation and the government of the day had very different objectives.
That was one of the things that came about through the searching of records in the National Archives and the Freedom of Information requests, because one of the first and rather shocking revelations was that I started looking at communications between the Foreign Office, Foreign and Commonwealth Office, and embassies around the world, and communications between the Foreign Office and the embassy in Libya, and internal cabinet records of meetings. Records of meetings, for example, between Margaret Thatcher, who was Prime Minister at the time, and Leon Britton, who was Home Secretary. Record of teleprinter message sent by Geoffrey Howe, who was the Foreign Secretary, to all heads of embassies around the world, keeping them informed of what was going on. And less than 24 hours after the shooting has happened, all these messages are saying that the Libyans are going to be allowed to go free and there's going to be no prosecutions within a day. As I was reading this, I think, how can this be so quick? And there's actually a record of a conversation between Leon Britton and Margaret Thatcher. Leon Britton is recorded as having said to Margaret Thatcher that given that we are going to be allowing murderers to leave the country, these are the words he used. And I thought, how can they have already decided that within 24 hours of this shooting happened, a WPC has been killed. It's all over the newspapers. Yet behind the scenes, the politicians have already decided that the people involved in the shooting are going to be allowed to go home. Why? There's got to be a reason. And of course, then it was like, keep digging till you find it.
Mm. Well, what were some of those reasons that that highlighted?
The main reason was that in 1983, Margaret Thatcher had been swept to power on a crest of a wave of popularity following the Falklands War. So she was in a really strong position, and the Conservative government was in a much stronger position than it had been for a long time. Historically, all the UK governments of all political persuasions had experienced year-on-year problems with the National Union of Mine Workers. The National Union of Mine Workers effectively held the UK governments of all persuasions, as I said, to ransom because they produced the fuel for the UK power stations. Most of the power stations were coal-fired. And so if the National Union of Mine Workers were in dispute with the government over something, working conditions, pay, whatever it was. No coal meant the lights went out. And the governments were sick of this. So Maggie Thatcher had briefed her government officials to come up with a plan to defeat the miners. And the plan was a relatively simple one. They said in 1983, we are going to build up sufficient coal reserves that when the strikers go out, we will have enough reserves to outlast them. The NUM realised what was going on, and they decided to work to rule so that these fuel reserves couldn't be built up. So by November, December 1983, the government were in a situation where they had a dispute looming that was due to start in around March 1984 with the NUM, but the reserves to enable them to actually defeat the miners weren't available. And so they came up with a plan B. And plan B was that there was enough oil-fired power stations within the UK to keep the lights running. But to keep them running, they needed enough oil. At that time, Libya was the subject of UN and United States sanctions. They were prohibited from selling oil on the open market. They had a glut of oil going cheap. Our secret services did a deal through the Libyan secret service to buy Libyan oil. Libyan oil started coming into the ports and to the UK, building up the oil reserves. The NUM didn't realise it was happening. And of course, what happened is Colonel Gaddafi, who has this campaign going against expatriate Libyans living abroad who are opposed to his regime, and he is using his security services, his external security services, to kill these people and assassinate them. There were bombings, there were shootings outside the London Mosque in central London. And people forget this. That he was very active. The reason he was so active was because he knew he had this deal going with the UK government, and he felt that he was untouchable. Yes. And so on this particular day when Yvonne was shot, they had hatched a plan to bring targets to central London so that they could be abducted from the streets outside the embassy, taken to waiting cars around the back of the embassy. They would then be taken to a private airfield, loaded onto a plane, taken back to Libya to put on trial, with the inevitable result, I'm sure. On the day, the police messed up their plans by simply putting steel barriers outside the embassy. Now, that wasn't a deliberate plan to stop the abduction attempts that were happening. It was simply there to, for public order reasons, to keep the opposing factions of demonstrators separate.
Which is what you do in any demonstration.
Which is what you do in any demonstration. It was good policing procedures by the people who are involved on the day, and it was a good practice, and it worked. But it also meant that the plans that the Libyans inside the embassy had to snatch their targets from the crowd outside couldn't work because there were these two lines of steel barriers between them and their targets. And so they got into a bit of a panic as to what they were going to do, because Gaddafi, who would not look at them very favourably if they failed, was expecting some of all, form of his action. He was expecting his enemies to be eliminated. And these students, revolutionary students within the embassy, thought, well, we need to come up with something. They had a plan to protect the embassy from counterattack or a rescue attempt by the police after the abduction. And what the plan was, that they were going to have two men with Sterling submachine guns on the first floor, and if the police attempted to rescue the people who they grabbed or to counterattack in some form, these people were there to defend the embassy. What happened was the defensive plan became an offensive plan. And instead of using these two machine gunners to defend the embassy from a rescue, They decided to use them to actually shoot at their targets within the crowd, and Yvonne was standing in the way.
How to bring WPC Fletcher's killer to justice? Maybanks made his position clear. Accepting that the suspects would inevitably be leaving UK jurisdiction within a few days didn't mean giving up. Whatever evidence gathering opportunities existed had to be exploited. Bill Hucklesby shared that view and was similarly determined. "They'll come again," he said. so we must make sure whatever evidence is out there will be available as and when it is needed.
Now, I know we talked earlier, didn't we, that the government had different objectives to the police at the time. And I think reading the book, to the Metropolitan Police's credit, they were not going to take that line down. And they hatched a plan, persuaded the Libyans through the Foreign Commonwealth Office to allow all those inside the embassy to be taken to Sunnydales, which is in Windsor, where all their diplomatic status would be checked prior to leaving the UK. That was the plan. Even the commissioner was on hand to shake hands with the Libyans, wishing them well on their journey. For many, a hugely disrespectful gesture, considering they had just lost one of their own. But in fact, the true purpose of bringing them to Sunnydales was entirely different.
Yeah, it was. It was the government just wanted these people out of the country. They needed to keep Gaddafi on side so they'd keep the oil flowing so they could beat the miners. They didn't want that deal to break down. The inquiry, the prosecution, was effectively being sacrificed on the altar of political expediency. The police weren't happy with that. And secretly, from the politicians, they hatched a plan to gather all the forensic evidence that they could, the logic being that, as is often said in the police, they'll come again. We might not be able to arrest them now. We might not be able to prosecute them now. But if we can identify them, then one day the opportunity will happen and that person will be back in the UK on a tourist visa or something like that. And we'll be saying, mister, we've got the evidence to arrest you. And so what they did was they set up Sunningdale as a forensic evidence gathering scenario. So when all those Libyans were taken to Sunningdale, from the very moment they walked in and they shook hands with the commissioner, what appeared to be a friendly greeting from the commissioner was seen by many officers in the special patrol group who ages afterwards expressed their horror and abhorrence of what they appeared their own commissioner was doing. What they didn't realise was that Sir Kenneth Newman spoke Arabic. And so he was greeting these people in their natural language. They were conversing with him and they were being recorded. And those voices were going to be compared to voice recordings that had been taken from within the Bureau itself, where conversations, no doubt, had revealed things about who was involved in the shooting. And they needed to identify who was who, which voice said that, which voice were they referring to. The tables and chairs, the glasses, the cutlery, everything was set up to secure forensic evidence. The tables that people were interviewed at were covered with a thin formica type film. So when somebody put their hand on it, after the interview was finished, the forensic people would come in, remove the film, and the people's fingerprints would be on it. So they could be compared to fingerprints that they were gathering from within the Bureau. It was very clever. It took longer than a simple processing of paperwork.
Yeah, I think the FCO were dancing up and down, weren't they?
And they were ringing Sunningdale and saying, what the hell's taking so long? You're simply supposed to be doing some paperwork before these people are taken off to Heathrow to be flown out of the country. The police never let on what they were doing. It only transpired later on what had really been going on, and the government were livid. They felt that the police had been acting arbitrarily, independently of their political masters, if you want to use that word, and that had to change.
And that set something in motion which we're seeing the dividends of today, isn't it? And we'll talk about that a little bit later.
Why Gaddafi changed his mind from that of a transient denier to being someone who actively supported the release of the hostages before any concession was made by the UK was a mystery. It was many years later, when Robin Plummer decided to write about his experience as a hostage, that the reason was revealed, as he explains here. We learned the truth during the debrief with the Foreign Commonwealth Office. Eventually, it came down to Gaddafi needing something that was more important than keeping us. His father had cancer, and the best available treatment was to be found in London. The only way he could secure a visa for his father was to agree to our release.
Now, in the subsequent days and months after the shooting, Westerners working in Libya were kidnapped by Gaddafi's regime as an insurance policy. to protect his own life. And Terry Waite, I believe, who famously became a hostage himself, became involved to help secure their release.
He did, that's right.
But once again, dark forces were at play, weren't they?
Yeah, I mean, as I began researching, I found references to a particular hostage who wasn't mentioned in any of the newspapers. And I found that was rather curious that this... There would be often debates in the House of Parliament, and they refer to four hostages. But there was actually this extra hostage who was a bit of a mystery. John Campbell, his name was, and he worked for a company called Poole Interdrill, who were an American-based company who worked in Libya drilling for oil. He disappeared on the day that Yvonne was shot. In fact, there's some evidence to suggest that he actually went just before Yvonne was shot. And unlike the other hostages who were taken to local prisons, he was taken to the home of the head of Libyan security and kept in this chap's personal villa. Certainly a very different way of being. And his existence was kept secret. And the conversations where members of the press would ask about this missing employee were closed down. And I thought, well, there's definitely something to do about this. So I did some Freedom of Information requests about him, naming him and saying, could I please have what information you have on this man? And I got a lot of material, a lot of which was redacted, which says a lot. The fact that they're redacted information about somebody says there's something to hide here. So what I did was I started comparing, for example, records of cabinet office meetings where his particular situation would be discussed with the open source material obtained through the National Archives. And you could look in the open source material and see what they were talking about and look at the redacted material and say, that's who they had to be talking about. And you could marry the two. And it was apparent that there was something special about him. He was looked after by a particular member of the British diplomatic staff in Libya who remained in Libya after the siege ended and all the other diplomatic staff came back. And I had this guy's name from various records, and I managed to get a copy of a manuscript written by another one of the hostages who named this guy who was looking after them. Couldn't find anything about this man. I thought, right, who do I know who else was involved in the negotiations that were going on at the time? And it was the very well-known journalist, Kate Adie. I got in touch with Kate Adie, and I thought, you know, nothing ventured, nothing gained. If she ignores me, I've not lost anything. She rang me up. Kate Adie on the telephone. Absolutely. Wow, this is Kate. What a nice lady. I told her what I was doing, told her what I was exploring and looking into, and she gave me some good ideas of, like John Le Carré had, of good places to look for information. But one of the things she particularly said to me was, I said about this chap who was looking after John Campbell, and I mentioned his name, and she said, yeah, I know him. And I said, oh, really? She said, yeah. She said he was well known to us journalists who were working in Libya. I said, you say it was him who was looking after your man Campbell. I said, right. She said, well, I think you'll find John Campbell's a spook. She said, because he's a spook. He said he was well known in journalistic circles as a member of MI6. He said, so he was the local desk officer for MI6. So he was looking after John Campbell. She said, I think you'll find that John Campbell was one of theirs. And that's the reason he was treated so differently from all the other hostages. And that's the reason his existence was kept out of the newspapers.
Yeah. And to be fair, when you say he was treated differently, he didn't have a good experience,
no.
Did he?
There's evidence from other hostages who didn't actually see it, but they were aware of a British hostage being tortured. They heard it. They heard this guy pleading with the people, with his torturers, for mercy. They realised it was a Brit. They didn't know who he was. When they were all released and they were on the plane on the way home, they were aware that this guy was on the plane with them, but didn't know who he was. And when they attempted to engage him in conversation, that conversation was closed down. And when they arrived in the UK, this chap went off with the local special branch officers. Again, it's all circumstantial, but it creates a picture of there's another interesting, mysterious side to this story that previously people were unaware of.
As the streets around the People's Bureau were reopened, people returned to their homes, offices and vehicles. Staff from a number of buildings were pleased to discover their tropical fish had been fed and cared for by the police officers as they kept watch from the windows.
Now, you mentioned Yvonne's hat, and that came about, didn't it? Because he was lying there at the scene, nobody could go in or out, but Yvonne's funeral was coming up and people wanted her hat on the coffin. And you talked about it a little bit earlier, so it is a dark book in that sense, and there's some sobering revelations of espionage and collusion, but it does have some beautiful vignettes of the British compassion and sheer blooded mindedness. So can you tell me about Clive Mabry?
Mabry.
Former paratrooper.
Yeah, legend. He's a legend. Yvonne's hat had become a sort of a negotiating symbol that the hostage negotiators who were talking to the Libyans holed up within the bureau, it was part of their discussion processes about the recovery of the hat. Because the hat was wanted to go on Yvonne's coffin as a tribute, effectively, to her. A couple of methods have been explored to try and recover the hat, one of which involved a trained spaniel, a drugs dog or something of that form, being taught to go out to the square, grab the hat and pull it back. And another involved a skilled fly fisherman who was a policeman, I think, out at Heathrow Airport, who had said that he reckoned that he could, with a fly rod, he could fling a fly and a hook across and hook the hat and drag it back. Some dry runs were done because they obviously wanted to practice to see if these theories would work. And particularly in the case of the dog, they were able to show that, yes, it could work and they could do it. And the dog could be taught to go out there, grab a hat and brought it back. The press got wind of it. And so the press ran a story a couple of days before it happened about how the police were practicing this method of recovering the hat. Everything the press was running, the people inside the bureau were getting to know about because they had the television to watch. And so that plan went out the window. They were back to square one of trying to talk the Libyans into allowing somebody to go and recover the hat. The Libyans weren't keen to do that. And this story had started to filter around the Met. Down in Lewisham in South London, a PC at Lewis and Division called Clive Mabry had heard these stories. And Clive, bless him, is a bit of a strong character. And he said, that is, to himself, that is entirely wrong. That should not happen. So he managed to get himself posted up to one of the serials of officers who were doing patrolling guard duty around the area. And he was sitting on a coach with the rest of the officers and with his inspector. And he said to them, you know, is it all right if we go and find a toilet? So him and a pal went off to find the toilet, except that Clive's idea was to go up and see the blue screen, which concealed St. James's Square. So he said to his mate, yeah, let's go up to the blue screen and have a look, see if we can see anything. His mate said, oh, no, I don't want to do that. You're on your own, Clive. So on his own, Clive goes up to the blue screen in Regent Street, which is blocking off Charles II Street, blocking off the entrance to St. James's Square. And he sees on the screen an inspector called Ragnar Tullett. And Ragnar is a former sergeant of his who's just been promoted to inspector. And he sees her and he thinks, wow, what an opportunity. So he goes across, hello, Ragnar, congratulations on your promotion. Any chance I could sneak behind the screen, have a quick cigarette? So Ragnar, who's with the sergeant, oh, yeah, Governor, I'd like to be able to have a quick fag as well. All right, go on, go to serve you. Round the back, make it quick. Ragnar gets called away on the radio to go and do something. Sergeant and Clive Mabry are around the back of the screen having a cigarette. Sergeant finishes his cigarette first, probably because Clive was taking a long time over his. And he says to Clive, look, when you finish the cigarette, you know, pack out the front and away you go. Clive is on his own. Now's his chance. So he walks down Charles II Street, not really knowing where he's going. And he goes past the glass control room booth. WPC sees him and thinks he's something official. Says to him, oh, hello, are you new up here? And he says, oh, yeah. He said, have you seen the hat? And he thinks, I can't believe my luck. And he said, well, no, I haven't. And he says, come over here. He says, come over to the armoured Land Rover and you can see it. If you look around the corner, you can glance. You can see the hat in the middle of the square. So he goes with this WPC and two senior officers walk over. They start engaging the WPC in conversation, but they ignore Clive. And Clive thinks, this is my chance. Now, what was going on is these two senior officers who were talking to the WPC, they were, in fact, me and my mate, the traffic officers.
Right.
They weren't senior officers. They were us two who turned up waiting to do these vehicle removals. Clive sneaks past us and just runs straight out into the square looking for the hat. Doesn't realise that the wind had previously picked up. And so the photographs that had appeared all over the press with the hat resting on the tarmac in the middle of the street, it's no longer there. And so he runs to the point where he thinks the hat is amongst all the helmets and it's gone. And he thinks, I've done it. I've messed my job up. I'm in trouble. And it's not even here. He then sees the hat where it's blown to the side of the road and it's jammed underneath a crash barrier. So he goes across and he can't get it out underneath the crash barrier. So he's pulling and tugging on this hat to get it out from under the crash barrier. And he can't get out. And he's looking over his shoulder at the embassy to see if there's any reaction and at the windows. Nobody's moving. And he's starting to panic when he thinks, well, I better get down on my knees, see if I can lift the barrier and get it. And he gets down his knees, lifts the barrier. He manages to release the hat. So he thinks, well, at least if this is going to cost me my job, at least I've got the hat. And at that point, he turned round and, like a good parachute regiment soldier, stood to attention and gave the Libyans a single finger salute. before walking quickly back towards where, as I previously mentioned, the firearms inspector had been shouting, get back, get back. Arm around his shoulder, grabbed him, took the hat from him and marched him off to the NatWest bank where he was about to be grilled by a numerous senior officers who overtly very cross with him, but privately very proud of him.
Perhaps the final words belong to PC John Murray. As I walked into court, it was heaving. We had so many supporters. They had to set up a live link to another court so they could all be accommodated. The press were there in droves. I sat down on a bench behind my barrister and took a deep breath. Over the next 3 days, 37 years of effort was going to be put to the test.
Well, as we start to come to the end of this interview, I suppose we can't really underestimate the lengths that PC John Murray went to bring his friend and colleagues, Yvonne Fletcher's killers, to justice. Setback after setback, covert visits to Libya, putting his own life in danger. He never gave up, ever, did he?
John's a remarkable character. He's somebody I think the police service can be extremely proud of. The kind of example of a policeman who, if he makes a promise, he's going to keep it, he's going to stick to his word. He promised Yvonne in the ambulance on the way to hospital that he would not rest until he had ensured that her killers were brought to justice. He didn't use those words to her, obviously, because obviously he didn't want to impart a message to her that he thought she was mortally wounded. But he did promise. And throughout the years, he has campaigned and campaigned and kept this topic in the public eye. And because he's done that, as the political situation has changed, as the regime in Libya has changed, we've ended up with a situation where, particularly when Colonel Gaddafi was killed, that witnesses who knew things, who were there on the day and who were involved, were confident to come forward in the knowledge, because of John, that this thing was still being investigated. They realised that the police hadn't lost interest because John had kept it in the news. Mm-hmm. And so they thought, well, obviously the police are still interested in finding out. So they started to come forward. These witnesses came forward. If John hadn't kept that in the public eye, I'm absolutely certain that these people would not have thought it worth coming forward. They'd have thought, it's all history, it's all forgotten, nobody's interested now. Because of what they did, because they came forward, the evidence started to come forward. They named people. They named the people in positions of power and control within the revolutionary committee that was operating within the embassy. They named the man in charge, Sali Ibrahim Mabrouk. He was the man responsible. He was the man who gave Colonel Gaddafi's orders to the people who actually pulled the triggers. He didn't pull the triggers on the machine guns, but he's the one that gave the instructions to the men. And as we know, under the law of common purpose, he is as responsible for murdering Yvonne and assaulting all the others who were shot as the gunmen themselves. And he is the man that John Murray was so keen to see in court.
And it's there is a remarkable ending to the book. And if people want to know that ending, they're going to have to read it.
that's an old cliche. Yeah, that's absolutely the case.
It is a cracking book. It really is. But finally, and we mentioned it earlier, didn't we, about how the government were livid that the police took the investigations out of their hands, really. And that produced a climate of change between the government and the police that we are seeing to this day now, aren't we?
Absolutely. I mean, there's two main effects that resulted from the 1984 Libyan embassy siege. As we know, this is probably one of the greatest tragedies in UK policing history. But it was also a watershed event because the police realised that they absolutely did not have the capacity to deal with armed terrorist attacks. They hadn't. If those Libyans inside the embassy had decided within a very short time of the incident happening that they were going to break out of the embassy shooting, we would not have been able to stop them. We did not have the means to do so. We did not have the equipment. We did not have the weaponry to be able to stop them. It was the day that attitudes to armed policing changed and the realisation that the police across the UK needed to up the ante if they were going to effectively deal with terrorists. But also, because the police had been so determined to see one of their own receive justice for her murder and to secure the evidence to obtain the arrest and prosecution, they had to act independently of the politicians who wanted it simply dusted under the carpet. And in doing so, it made the politicians realise that the independent police service had its advantages, but also had its disadvantages. And they weren't comfortable with that. And so they set and started on, and this was instigated in the main by Margaret Thatcher, who started a process of politicising the police with a view to bringing them under political control, so that policing priorities, so that policing methods and police, all kinds of things related to the police, would be effectively controlled through political expediency and not according to public need. That's their decision. Over the years, legislation was brought in. It was continuous. It started off with the Security Services Act, which handed over responsibility for terrorists' investigation to the security services, taking it away from the police. And it ended, well, it hasn't ended really, but it culminated in the introduction of the Police and Crime Commissioners, which effectively leaves us with a position where civilians voted in with no experience or relevant knowledge, can decide what policing priorities should be. And those policing priorities are set in accordance with vote winning, because they're never going to introduce unpopular measures because they know they're going to get voted out. A police organisation that is secure and strong in its position can run the risk of doing things which are unpopular because they don't run the risk of being voted out. Political control of policing was a bad idea. It was never going to work. But I'm sad to say that it's been 37 years in the creation and it's going to take a long time to fix.
Matt Johnson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
DCT Audio. The art of good listening.